Welcome to the Against the Stream Nashville podcast. We're very excited to announce that we are changing our name to Wild Heart Meditation Center. You can stay subscribed to the podcast as you currently are, or if you choose to join us again at a later date in the future, just remember to search wherever you get your podcasts for Wild Heart Meditation Center. We're excited to be introducing new facilitators to our group and expanding our presence in our local community. Enjoy. Tonight I wanted to talk about the first of the Buddhist teachings, this teaching on dukkha, and this is an essential aspect of developing insight and trying to ease suffering and find well-being in our lives, is to be willing to look at the ways that we, suffer. It's kind of a heavy word, but the ways that we experience dis-ease. And the Buddha really encourages us to turn towards that, to look at and to be honest about the difficulty in our life, and to kind of come together in community and to flush that out, and to sit in meditation and to watch these neurotic, obsessive, reactive habits of our mind so we can get to know them. To be able to see clearly into the nature of the ways in which we suffer means that we then have the awareness to move through that experience. And we have the awareness to be able to alleviate some of the often unconscious reactive habits of our mind. Because a lot of the ways that I react throughout my day, in retrospect, I wish I hadn't. And they just seem to be almost like muscle memory. Someone, family member challenges me at the dinner table, automatic defensiveness, my boss sends me an email about some work I didn't do, it's shut down maybe. Some of our ways of reacting aren't intentional, they just have formed through years of unconscious practicing them. And so I wanted to start by just sharing this quote that I have here on the board by Viktor Frankl. He said that when we are no longer able to change a situation, we're challenged to change ourselves. And we'll circle back around to this quote, but I think it's just a good reflection for this topic. The Buddha emphasized two core principles in his teaching. There are a lot of principles, but two things that were very unique to how the Buddha taught. One is he really encouraged people to be accountable to their own actions. So this kind of in recovery language I've learned, looking at your side of the street kind of thing. I think this is one of the most valuable principles to uphold in any type of spiritual path, is being willing to really look at ourselves closely and be accountable to our actions. The Buddha really interestingly demoted the role of gods and metaphysics in the quest for spiritual awakening. Right? I actually personally feel like a lot of the Buddha's teachings, there's not a whole lot that's really spiritual about it. It's more psychological. He promoted the idea that awakening or transformation of perspective and easing the dis-ease and distress in our life, that awakening is a matter of ethical living and psychological training, not spiritual grace. This is very different than a lot of Western religion, most notably, and not to knock, but just to say, the kind of Judeo-Christian view of salvation. In Judeo-Christianity, salvation is a birthright, from being saved by, a human being, God in the form of human, that sacrificed his flesh and blood for the benefit of mankind. Buddhism is very different The salvation model is that each one of us has to do the work ourselves to free ourselves from suffering in this world. And it's done not as much through spirituality as much through action, through thought and speech and physical behavior. That beings are the owners of their actions, as the Buddha says, the heirs of their actions. They're born from their actions. Whatever that you, in whatever ways you act, to that you will fall heir, is what he says. So this isn't a ontological, philosophical assertion of what is in the world, but it's rather the Buddha's personal reflection on what causes well-being. That happiness, from a Buddhist perspective, is a collection of good habits. You know, the feeling of being happy or joy is a fleeting emotion. But contentment is found by doing things that are in line with our integrity and living in that scope or that frame of ethics, and also watching the motivations of the mind, because all of our actions start first with impulses internally, movements of the mind to act, to react, to speak. And so by training our mind to have more awareness of our internal world, our thoughts, feelings, and emotions, and also by holding some ethical trainings and practices of non-harming, you know, we're able to find well-being and support well-being not only for ourselves but for the world. And I say that to say, like I said earlier, this isn't to say that one method of religion or spirituality is better than another. It's just to say that the way that the Buddha taught was vastly different than I think we're used to in our whole way of thinking about spirituality and religion. It's not about orthodoxy in Buddhism, which is a belief in. The Buddha doesn't care what you believe as much as what you do. And you tend to do what you believe, so you got to watch both of them. You know, the path is wise view, which is our perspectives, wise intention, which is our motivations. Our perspectives on the world inform what we're motivated to do. It's wise speech, wise action, wise livelihood, wise effort, wise mindfulness, wise concentration. He offered a holistic system of practice, of inquiry, not of dogma. And he said that, you know, each one of us must do the work ourselves to free ourselves from suffering. You know, the suffering of the mind. And we'll talk about this word suffering in a little bit. So he encouraged a reflection on our views and intentions, a reflection on ethical living, a practice of diligent effort, and a deep practice of moment-to-moment awareness, investigation, and focus. The Buddha is kind of a therapist of sorts. He also taught in a really interesting way, and hopefully this kind of smooths down some of the, preaching or sermon giving about the Buddha's teaching. He also really taught from this principle of what's called ehipasiko and opanayaka, which is come and see for yourself, ehipasiko, which he said, you know, don't trust me. You know, I'm not giving you commandments, but come and see. Sit down and watch your mind. If you want to understand your mind, you got to sit down and watch it. You know, come and see what are the causes of well-being. He says in a famous sutta, he says to the Kalamas, you know, that you shouldn't believe in doctrine or in my word or in the teachings of a wise teacher. He said that only when you have developed and cultivated causes of well-being in yourself, and you know that this leads to my welfare, this leads to my happiness, he said, then you should practice that. And he said how we learn to do that is this other principle, opanayaka, which means to be brought inside oneself. Contemplation, reflection, introspection. One of the beautiful things about having a human brain is we can think about thinking. You know, we can think about our behavior. We can think about, you know, how we are in the world. And we really have to look closely in our lives to see what's working and what's not. I think it's a natural part of having a human brain is that we're introspective. We all have had moments of clarity, right? We've all had moments where we're like, oh shit, this is what I've been doing for the last 5-10 years, you know, or oh, this is the same person I dated last time, right? It's like you arrive at these conclusions sometimes after struggling with them for some time, and that's okay, you know, but we have this ability to look internally, you know, to kind of check in with what's working and what's not. So these kind of 2-3 principles are important. Personal responsibility. We each have to do the work ourselves. No one's going to do it for us. Ahipasco, you have to come and see for yourself. Don't believe any particular rite or ritual or spiritual practice. I've noticed changes over the years anyway. What I used to, you know, the form that I used to practice when I first started meditating is the form, is different form that I practice now. And it hopefully will be different in 5-10 years. So we have to come and see for ourselves, and we have to be introspective. And so where to start? Well, the Buddha said, you know, we want to start by being honest with ourselves about the ways that we do suffer. I think culturally we tend to have a, not by choice, maybe been born into this American dream mentality that, you know, life is supposed to be a linear progression of success. You know, it's like success equals hard work and opportunity and entrepreneurship, and it's, you know, one form of success. And the Buddha actually said that material success does bring contentment and pleasure and joy. And I think all of us can find that to be true for ourselves. But that, you know, life is inherently unpredictable, or I like the word vulnerable. The etymology of the word vulnerable comes from the Latin root vulnere, which means susceptibility to woundedness. That being born into this world is a fragile experience, if we're being honest about it. Without being morbid, because that's not the point. The point is to investigate and to see that as we are born, we grow old. As we grow old, our bodies change, deteriorate, get sick, become ailed. We are separated from those who are dear to us during this life. And then there are all the other things that happen to us that we can't control. You know, jobs change and relationships come and go. Life, as the Chinese Buddhists say, is equally 10,000 joys and 10,000 sorrows. It's beautiful and tragic. And that's what life is. And so we're looking at here with this practice in the Buddha's Dharma is to just not argue with what's inarguable. Because when we argue with what's inarguable, we suffer. And the Buddha distinguishes a difference between pain and suffering. And we'll talk a little bit about it. So the Buddha's encouragement is not to believe this, but to fully know dukkha. That was his task. I think it's dukkha parinya, which means to fully know. This word dukkha I'm using, I just realized I haven't said what that is. The etymology of the word dukkha, it's a Pali Sanskrit word, which is the language that the Buddha's teachings were later recorded in. It was an unspoken dialect that was they call it a Middle Indo-Aryan dialect. It was kind of a people's written language. And the word dukkha, the reason why I don't like to translate is, one, because if you're coming around to Buddhist circles, you'll hear it sooner rather than later. So it's good to get familiar with it. And two, it's not really easy to translate. But this is what the Buddha's pointing to, is this kind of dis-ease, dissatisfaction, the friction and stress, the vulnerability of life that we often argue with. And so the word dukkha actually means something like bad empty. And what it refers to most commonly is you would say that, like, back in the day, if you're riding on an ox cart and one of the wheels isn't quite lined up with the axle just right, I like to give this example. It's like the shopping cart with the shitty wheel at the grocery store. That's dukkha. Right? Like 70, 80% of the time you can navigate this cart all right, but you turn a corner and it just kind of stops, you know, and then you have to figure it out and you fight with it and you get pissed at it and you kick it and you, you know, or abandon it in the middle of the grocery store. You know, there's this kind of like subtle flavor of disjointedness to life that is inarguable. It's very real that the Buddha says, actually, he gives a definition of what it is. He said, this is dukkha. Birth is dukkha. Aging is dukkha. Sickness is dukkha. Death is dukkha. Encountering what is not dear is dukkha. Separation from what is dear is dukkha. Not getting what one wants is dukkha.
What is dear? Like, what does he mean by dear?
Being separated from what is dear, meaning that something that we love, something that we that is dear to us, that we love and care about. Yeah. I like to say that there are kind of three. Well, it just helps to talk about. I don't think the Buddha talked about it in this way, but there are kind of three different maybe degrees of dukkha. One is disjointedness, which is what I talked about earlier with the shopping cart wheel, is when things don't quite fit the way we want them to. And a lot of disjointedness has to do with our expectations versus reality. Like when I go to the grocery store, I don't even think, oh, I might get the cart with the shitty wheel. Right, you just kind of go in the assumption that's unconscious is that things will just kind of flow to our liking, right? That we all have unconscious preferences. We like things to be comfortable. We don't like things to be uncomfortable. Not our fault. Wired into the nervous system. There's actually a neuroscientist named Melvin Connor that studied the human nervous system. He said that our chronic internal state is one of wanting. Wanting things to be comfortable and wanting to get rid of things that are uncomfortable. And that when things don't quite line up with our preferences, they become disjointed. We become unsatisfied. It's like I bought a car back in August. And holy shit, that is like a test of spiritual practice when you go into a car dealership. I was there for 6 hours, and I found the perfect car, right color, right, you know, interior, right model, right amount of mileage. Everything was right. And I, you know, looked through the car was perfect, bought the car. Got the car, and there's this little stain on the back seat. You know, it seems like you could never get anything that's just doesn't have a little stain on it. Right? It's just a little out of joint. I noticed this. We also fixed our bathroom recently and redid some of the trim, and one of the trim's like an inch beneath the rest of the trim. It's like no one's going to notice that shit, right? But the eye draws directly towards it. It's like always looking at this just thing that's not quite lining up. Disjointedness. Another dimension or degree of dukkha is what I just call stress. I like the word stress, actually, because we use this a lot in our culture. Right? There's actually mindfulness-based stress reduction. Well, stress, to me, it sounds a lot like speed. So stress has to do with this kind of like, it actually means in physics when an object lacks the inner resources to meet its external demands, right? I like that definition. When an object lacks the inner resources to meet its external demands. So stress is placed upon us when we feel like we don't have what we need to meet the demands of our external world. That life requires constant work and upkeep. Right, that we have to feed our bodies, we have to take care of them, we have to, right, even spiritual development takes work, even mindfulness takes work. You know, so some of this is like unavoidable, that life is work in a way. Right, the bills seem to keep coming, you know. The third degree of dukkha is despair. And despair is that things are vastly different than how they should be. Despair is grief. It's the big dukkha. You know, it's the death and loss. We lose children. People experience abuse. People experience neglect. These are very real, you know, aspects of the human world. And so the Buddha is really encouraging us not to figure dukkha out, but to turn towards it, right? Like this is, the Buddha recounted his awakening experience after he, in the myth, you know, sat down for several days and, you know, was able to look into the nature of disease and suffering in his mind. And he said that, you know, what he had to do to overcome the dis-ease in his mind was so against the stream, as he said, that what was being required was to turn towards the very parts of our human experience that we don't want to. And there are three flavors of dukkha. So there are three degrees: disjointedness, stress, despair. So it's like from maybe less suffering to more suffering is degrees. And then there are three flavors, which are just different categories. And this is really what the Buddha taught. The first is dukkha dukkha. Dukkha dukkha is the physical and mental suffering associated with birth, growing old, illness, and dying. These are truly the inarguables, right? The physical body is a realm of discomfort. Just like I said earlier, you can't tell your mind to stop thinking. You don't. If you're born with the ability to hear, you don't tell your ears to stop hearing. You can't tell your body to stop feeling. And so your body is sensitive. You have a nervous system that is sensitive. But we live in a brain that argues that all the time. And a big part of this is what the Buddha calls dukkha dukkha, is that we argue with the inevitable sensitivity of our body. Like, what makes pain so bad is the mental attitude that we can't bear it for a second longer. Right? And we can't help it. I mean, pain hurts. But the mental attitude that we can't bear it for a second longer is this dukkha dukkha. It's this kind of mental resistance or reaction to that physical element of life. We get sick, we become injured. We may have very challenging physical limitations. The world's not set up to help people that are otherly abled, right? There's one ability level for the world, for the most part. Fortunately, most places these days have wheelchair ramps and are more accessible, but by and large, we expect people hear, they see, they walk. People may have terminal illnesses. So we're not able to escape this objective reality of birth, aging, sickness, and death, but we can escape the denial and resistance of it. We can come to terms with it, is what the Buddha says. And that's not an overnight type of practice, right? That's an overtime type of practice. And this has been very real for me. I mean, I by no means am close to coming to terms with death, but it actually gets harder as I have a wife and, you know, we're trying to build a little family and more attachments are in the picture. And so, but it has become apparent, like if you go on a long meditation retreat, and Janae was just saying she just got back from a meditation retreat. If you go on a long meditation retreat, you're not talking to anyone. You're sitting quietly with yourself, and the pains are there and all the feelings, and it's just unavoidable. And part of the struggle on a meditation retreat is you keep somehow thinking that it's supposed to be peaceful and blissful, but it's not. It's what is. It's like body pain, mind active. Mind wants to do something. There's nothing to do. I'm sorry, mind. I've sat 2-month-long retreats where, you know, for 30 days, the mind has nowhere to go, nothing to do, no one to be. There's no personality to defend. There's no buddy to entertain. There's no fun stories to tell. There's nothing. And it's just the mind and the body reacting and resisting just what it's sensitive to. Its nature is to think. Its nature is to feel.
Question?
Yeah.
So how do you cope with it? You go to that kind of 30-day, really the right setting.
Yeah.
How do you respond?
So you watch the mind. You watch the mind's reaction. And this is the part of dukkha-dukkha that we're really trying to work with, is which they call the second arrow. And this is where I like to say that, like earlier, pain is inevitable and suffering is optional. That the mind thinks, the mind's restless, the body feels, the body hurts. It's what is, and there's somehow this attitude that it should be different. And somehow as you learn to cope with the attitude, and you actually learn to just let the mind be and let the body be, easier said than done, but that's the practice. As you learn to be with the first arrow of discomfort, you pull out the second arrow of suffering and reactivity around it. And it's, you know, it's a practice, but you get to see this very quickly in mindfulness, which is where, you know, like, simple example, you get in a car wreck, the mind just wants to resist that. But once it's done, it's done. There's no amount of despairing or tantrum that could be done to change that experience once it's done. And so the reaction to that experience is what we can work on. You know, we can lessen, we can soften the reactivity to the distress, to the discomfort. So it's hard work. I mean, we can acknowledge in mindfulness unpleasant feelings. We can acknowledge experiences of grief in life and learn to develop space to hold and to care for them. The Buddha said that the antidote for dukkha is compassion. And compassion comes through understanding and care. Instead of saying, it should be different, we say, I am so sorry. I feel you. I care about you. There's another type of dukkha called sankhara dukkha. And sankhara dukkha is a sense of lack or of dissatisfaction that arises when things don't quite measure up to our expectations and standards. Kind of like I talked about earlier with the disjointedness. Sankhara dukkha is kind of an emotional reactivity, a sense of lack or dissatisfaction that we experience when things don't meet our expectations. So this is what I like to call the mind's reactions or the emotional reactions, like should and shouldn't. When we go into that story in the mind and we say, it should not be this way, or this should be different, or you should be different. Okay. This is kind of our emotional reactivity. It's also all or nothing type thinking, extreme thinking. This kind of mentality for things to be either one thing or another way, which causes a lot of suffering. We see this with our divisiveness in the political world. There's just this natural human tendency we have to like to know. We like to know, so we put things in a little category. The mind does that by itself. It's not our fault. The mind likes to be secure, so it says, okay, these people are Republicans and these people are Democrats. And then it says, all right, all these people believe these sets of ideologies, all these people believe these sets of ideologies. And now what we've done is we've created tribalism. Well, now I get to kind of figure out which one I'm in, and I get to project all of my distaste and reactions and should and shouldn'ts onto the enemy. Yeah, and again, this isn't, you know, what we want to do. And I think we know, and we do know, we have moments of awakening where we see, well, yeah, people are people and politics are essential and they're more than just solid boundaries. things are very gray, right? Things, the world is very complex. Sankara dukkha is this kind of feeling of reaction from our expectations and standards, the stories we form, even about ourselves, like this kind of the story of I'll always be. I'll always be. I've always been. You've always been. Who says? You ever challenge your mind and be like, dude, how do you know that I'm always going to be single and I'm never going to find anyone? I'm always going to be in the same relationship. It's always going to be this way because it's been for 5 years and because you're not getting any better. It's like, maybe that's the problem, not me getting a partner. Maybe it's the mind's judgment, right? The sankhara, the emotional reactivity itself, this kind of core shame that Brené Brown talks about.
Like wrong 100% of the time, too.
Say what?
Like wrong 100% of the time, too.
We're wrong. I think we're wrong about what it means to be wrong. Like, we like to be right and to be perfect. And that's just not reality, right? We actually fail, and failing is good. You know, but like when we're able to see that and say, oh, I tried and it didn't quite work out to my preferences. And, you know, I can learn from that experience and get support. And so you see, this is kind of very subtle, the mind's kind of ways of preferences. Once I get X, then I'll be happy. Or if only I had, or what I call the I'd rather be's. I'd rather be with someone else, doing something else. The last type of dukkha is viparinama dukkha, which is the anxiety of trying to hold on to things that are constantly changing. This is mostly what's talked about when you're enjoying like a pleasant experience. Somehow the brain tends to think that when things feel good, they are good, and that's the way it should be. You know, and again, it's not our fault, but it's like you're on Sunday, the weather's out, you know, the weather's nice, you're in the park, first day of spring, you got the ice cream, you got the right people, you got the right amount of laughter, you know, maybe you got the right high going on, just everything's just right. You know, it's like the mind tends to want to hold on to these experiences. And this is where you get like a lot of addiction. This is kind of like trying to keep up the pleasurable feelings and holding on to feelings that are actually impermanent. It's like, oh, wow, all those conditions came together. They produced a very strong, pleasant feeling. Practicing, enjoying that and having gratitude and non-attached appreciation is what the Buddha is really encouraging us to do. But that those experiences are conditional. Experience, it changes. And because things change, we suffer. Because we don't want the good things to change. We only want the bad things to change. But all things change. One way that I like to talk about this is something that I've coined. I call Sunday dukkha, which is the feeling I used to get as a kid on Sundays, where I could enjoy Friday night was like the best night of my life. Saturday was amazing. Sunday would come around and I couldn't even enjoy or appreciate the day off because I was just constantly dreading going to school the next day. This kind of like anticipating the end of something. Or when something ends, trying to hold on to it or recreate it, right? Like staying up till 4 in the morning on Sunday night to just stretch out that pleasant experience. You know, we do this all the time. It's very subtle. And again, the most important thing here is that this isn't our fault. The Buddha's not saying change that about yourself. What he's saying is to look at how our tendencies to push and pull and mold experience to be comfortable to our liking all the time creates this constant stress and upkeep, that it becomes disjointed because we don't get the things that we want all the time, and that eventually we have to experience these existential kind of levels of despair and loss and grief. That to not argue with those experiences means to live more in line with the way things are. And when we do that, we suffer less. We embrace our humanity, and that's a practice. So what we do, well, we can learn how to practice a simple way of putting this, like the serenity prayer, right? Accept the things I can't change. Have the courage to change the things I can. The wisdom to know the difference. What gives me the wisdom to know the difference between what I can accept, what I need to accept, and what I can actually influence and change? Mindfulness. Being in the moment and saying, how is this? What is this? Wait a second. You know, this seems to just be happening. I can't really do anything to fix this, change this, or control this. It just kind of is. And can I maybe work on letting it be? I like that much better than letting it go. We don't really get to choose when we let things go. Things just fucking come, and then they go. We can choose if we want to let things be, or if we can let things be and we can influence things. And the Buddha is saying, when you change, when you influence things, to do it in an ethical way, to do it in a way that's intentional, to do it in a way that's not reactive, a way that's, you know, proactive, that's action that's done in line with value. So what is this experience? How is it? How am I meeting it? It's very simple. It's so simple, it's the hardest thing in the world to talk about every week. Right? This kind of falling asleep into our mind. Normal. Waking up. Less normal. Can become more normal. You know, we can start to see where we get caught in our reactions and say, oh shit, I'm in the rehearsing again. All right, Andrew, rehearsing, rehearsing, rehearsing. I know what that feels like. All right, drop into the body. Oh, there's that familiar fearful feeling that's like rushing up and down my chest. All right. Can I just be with the feeling? The mind says, well, don't you want to rehearse what you're going to say? Not right now. Just breathe. Okay. Let it be. You know, it's what is it? How is it? What does it need? Mindfulness. Seeing clearly and responding wisely. It comes down to honest self-reflection also. It's just being willing to be honest about the ways that we suffer. I like to just take time to reflect on what's hard, what's been hard. I actually took the last 2 days to do nothing. And just, I try to do that every once in a while. My teacher used to tell me to do it once a week. I find it harder and harder to do that these days, but I like to, when I can, once a week. I like this kind of Christian idea of Sabbath, right? And the Jewish idea of, what do they call it on Saturdays?
Shabbat.
I like this idea of kind of taking rest and like not doing, to be able to actually sit in inventory, you know, or in reflection, to actually sit with painful feelings. You ever like have the attitude that, like giving a presentation or talking in front of people. I don't know. We've got a lot of performers here in Nashville. It's like, all right, anxiety, if you just fucking leave me alone this one time, I'll be with you all the other times. Just leave me alone this one time, please. You're like going on the date. You're like, just please don't come with me on the date. It's like, but I never get around to actually be like, all right, anxiety, I'm going to sit down and let you have your time. You know, you know, you've got 6 hours. I'll sit down and just see what that's like. There's this really interesting, it's you know, ahipasco, see for yourself. There's a really liberating aspect to sitting with parts of ourselves that we don't want to. You know, the worst feeling in the world is when I wanted something from someone, especially when I was a kid, and I just wanted someone to acknowledge how I was feeling, and they tried to fix me. You know, and I just wanted someone to look at me and be like, hey, what's wrong? And me be like, dude, this world is insane. And no one told me that. And then be like, oh, yeah, it really fucking is. You know, because that's how I felt when I was a kid. And this teaching of dukkha was very normalizing for me. I was very grateful that the Buddha is like right out the gate. He's like, life is difficult. It's stressful. It is. You know, we get what we don't want. We, you know, don't get what we do want. That's how it really is. And we've got to learn how to work with that. We've got to learn how to like embrace that and have compassion and presence and care. And so, you know, being honest about the ways that we suffer and being willing to sit down with that stuff. That's not easy. So what we need is accountability. Human beings, I mean, I'll just speak, what I need for is accountability. We are not, when given an option whether to do that or not, I'm going to pick not. You know, but when I have a place to come to where it's kind of the culture, when I have a friend to call, or when I have like a daily practice to tend to, I can start to see when I get off and I can adjust. And so the last thing is, you know, to come back to this quote. When we're no longer able to change a situation, we're challenged to change ourselves. I would say that the kind of Buddhist perspective is when you're no longer able to change a situation, we're challenged to change our relationship to that situation. Right? We're learning how to practice relating to whatever we're experiencing. You know, with patience, kindness, compassion, healthy limits and boundaries, you know, with awareness and intention, seeing clearly and responding wisely, wisdom and compassion. So I want to open it up, some of my thoughts on dukkha.